Well, I'm now going to reveal the name of our previously unnamed and secret guest. And he doesn't have an ID card, but his name is David Coulthard, and he's the Shadow Minister, Shadow Justice Minister in Zimbabwe, and a very prominent human rights lawyer in Africa. He's here with a little bit of help from Bond University, from a very energetic law department there, to bring us up to speed on what's happening in Zimbabwe, because, of course, we don't hear much, in large part to the banning of most foreign correspondents by the Mugabe government, and to some extent because no one's sufficiently bloody interested. David, first of all, I know that you survived a quite serious assassination attempt. Is that why things are pretty hush-hush when you move around, or was it important to keep this quiet so you could get out of Zimbabwe?
Well, it's a very unpredictable regime, Philip, and I don't want them to disrupt my travel plans, and that's why it was kept hush-hush, so that I could at least get out and spread the word.
I just want to go quickly over a couple of points that you and I were having before the program. It's your degree of celebrity that now gives you some greater protection, is it not, in Zimbabwe?
Well, the higher your profile, the harder it is for this regime to have a go at you. 2 years ago, when they did have a go at me, they didn't succeed, fortunately. But many of my black colleagues have suffered a far worse fate. In fact, six of my fellow MPs in the last parliamentary session died directly or indirectly as a result of torture and other forms of state-sponsored violence.
Well, talking about deaths, there's about to be a great many in your country. Let's look at the situation in regard to the availability, perhaps the deliberate unavailability of food. How acute is the shortage?
James Morris, the director of the World Food Programme, 2 weeks ago in the United Nations, said that the gravest humanitarian crisis in the world is in southern Africa. And he pointed out that the epicenter is, in fact, Zimbabwe, where over 4 million people are facing this horrific combination of very high incidence of AIDS, of food shortages, and now the depredations of this regime through its so-called Operation Muramba Tsvina, or Clean Out the Filth campaign. And it's this dreadful combination that has caused this very grave humanitarian crisis.
How significant was the seizure of, 90% of large, productive, white-owned farms in terms of adding to the food crisis?
Well, in response to that, let me just say that 30% of our foreign exchange came from our tobacco crop alone. So with the removal of that in isolation, it's led to very severe foreign exchange shortages, a loss of human resources.
But you don't eat tobacco.
We don't eat tobacco, but it's tobacco that pays for our fuel and food and other importations.
Mm. Okay. How long-term is the damage to the rural economy, to the ability of Zimbabwe to feed its own people, as opposed to letting them roll their own cigarettes?
The food crisis this year has been exacerbated by a midsummer drought, which led to a huge reduction in the summer crop, which would have been avoided had our irrigation farmers been able to farm. So it has directly led to these huge food shortages.
I've just been reading a very powerful address to the Cape Town Press Club by Judith Todd, demanding international action on what's going on in Zimbabwe. She uses a word which I know you don't like using. She uses the genocide word. She sees this as a part of a quite deliberate campaign by Mugabe to reduce the population by about 4 million.
I'm cautious about using genocide, but Genocide Watch says that of the 10 indicators, Zimbabwe meets 8 of the 10 indicators for genocide. I don't think it's genocide yet. It's moving that way. I'd rather describe it as a crime against humanity. But one thing that Judith Todd does say, which I think is the most important message for Australia and the international community, is he says the Mugabe regime will not stop what it's doing until it is stopped.
Our next guest is George Ellis, who's a very prominent scientist and academic from Cape Town, who's as concerned about what's happening in Zimbabwe as you are, and he was telling me just briefly, we might get round to it on air, he was saying that he's been trying to get the South African government, his government, to do something about it, but he finds their vacillation appalling. You now tell me that South Africa is about to give Zimbabwe a huge amount of money.
Well, that was the lead story in Johannesburg's Business Day newspaper yesterday. They said that South Africa's foreign minister and governor of the South African Reserve Bank met their counterparts in Pretoria on Friday to discuss a 1 billion rand line of credit to the Mugabe regime.
With strings attached?
Well, we don't know. And we don't know, in fairness to them, whether this line of credit will be approved. But the point is that they're discussing. So far from this being quiet diplomacy, this seems to be quiet buttressing of the Mugabe regime.
Okay, mass evictions in shanty towns. The UN estimates in the region of 250,000 people have had their homes razed. It smacks of what's known as ethnic cleansing, but it's called drive-out rubbish.
That's right.
That's the official name for it.
Well, the official Shona name is Operation Murambatswina, which means drive out the trash, literally. And this is terminology that the Mugabe regime has used against its political opponents for many years. In the 1980s, we had Gukuruhundi, which was the campaign against the Ndebele people in the southwest of the country that led to 20,000 people dying. Our fear is that more people could die through the combination of AIDS, lack of food, and now a lack of shelter at the height of winter.
Where are those people going apart from the grave?
Well, before they get to the grave, they've been taken in by churches. They've had to double up with other poor people. And many of them, thousands of them, are out literally in the open at the height of winter. So it's a catastrophic situation.
I don't understand why the other African nations, often not spectacularly well run themselves, aren't up in arms, literally, over this issue. It seems so appalling.
It's a very complex issue. Robert Mugabe hits all the right buttons in Africa, and especially in South Africa, which makes it difficult for African leaders to respond to him. He talks about race, he talks about imperialism, and he talks about land. And of course, all of those issues are unresolved issues in South Africa. So President Mbeki, in fairness to him, has to tiptoe around Robert Mugabe. But also, there is, of course, the Band of Brothers. I think some of them...
The Band of Brothers.
In a quiet way, I think that they take a few tips, get a few leads from Robert Mugabe. They learn from him how to stay in power.
A touch of the North Korea, you
absolutely.
Mean. Because some of his lads were trained there, were they not?
Well, the notorious 5th Brigade, which led to what was genocide between 1983 and 1987, was trained by the North Koreans, specifically in this euphemistic way, to quell internal dissent, but actually which was used to crush the opposition.
Okay, Robert Mugabe says the clearances are designed to restore sanity to parts of the cities that have been overrun with criminals. Does he have a point?
Absolutely not. His police have acted illegally. They haven't followed our own laws in terms of giving people notice, adequate notice, where they've got illegal structures. The motivation behind this is mainly a retribution. He's gone against people who voted against him in the March parliamentary elections. It also is an indication of fear. He knows that people are dissatisfied. There's the potential of them rising up, so it's a preemptive strike. And it is also to extend patronage to control areas where politically he doesn't control.
Let's go back to the South African relationship. What is his relationship with the ANC leadership, and in particular with the old leadership of the ANC?
Well, that's the interesting thing about this, because historically both ZANU-PF and the PAC were in the Chinese orbit.
Identify those for the listener.
Well, the PAC was the ANC's principal opponents. They've suffered a collapse in their political fortunes. But At the time South Africa became independent, or gained its freedom rather, in 1994, the PAC was the ANC's main challenger, and ZANU-PF, Robert Mugabe's party, was supported by the Chinese, who in turn supported the PAC, whereas the ANC and Mugabe's opposition, Joshua Nkomo's ZAPU party, were in the Russian orbit. So there's no historical link between the two. In fact, as recently as 1994, in the first South African general elections, Robert Mugabe's party supported the PAC.
We should be wishing Nelson Mandela a happy birthday. You spoke to him personally about the situation in Zimbabwe. What is his view? Does he just want to not undermine the new president in South Africa?
Yes, he is desperately concerned about the situation. In fact, in 2000, he spoke out openly against Robert Mugabe. But he understands that it's a very divisive issue within the ANC. The ANC is split between COSATU and the Communist Party on the one hand, and the exiles led by Mbeki on the other. And I think Nelson Mandela understands that this issue has the potential to divide the ANC.
Because of the new regulations about the ID card, it is time for me to identify the guest and the program. He is David Coltart, the Shadow Minister for Justice in Zimbabwe. Now, you don't have a lot of justice in Zimbabwe at the moment, so it can't be a very big job. This is LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web, and the pod. David, dear oh dear, what's the relationship now between the government and the War of Independence veterans, you know, who initiated the takeover of the farms?
Well, their relationship has been damaged, especially in the last 5 weeks, because ironically, many of the war veterans had informal structures themselves that have now been destroyed.
Oh, of course, it's their places being knocked over as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, the wealthy, rich elite, the ZANU-PF elite, have not had their homes knocked down. It's the poorest of the poor who have been affected. So it's undermined that relationship.
Is that not a dangerous thing to undermine, that relationship?
Well, I think it is, but this regime is showing all the signs of its final days, and it's sort of lashing out against everyone.
Well, okay, let's hope that that's the case, but a lot of people outside of Zimbabwe have been waiting for a popular uprising. So widespread is the anger towards his government. David, why hasn't it happened?
I think the main reason is that Zimbabwean people have been through two civil wars in recent history. They went through the liberation struggle against white minority rule in the 1970s, and the people in the southwest had to go through the so-called Gukuruhundi, the 5th Brigade, the North Korean genocide. Mm. And I think because of that, they'll do everything in their power to avoid bloodshed. I think as well that there are signs that this regime is crumbling. And I think so long as people see that progression, they hold out for a peaceful velvet revolution.
David, forgive me being personal, but I can't help noticing that you're not black. Can you give me a rundown on how you, David Coltart, became the Shadow Justice Minister in Zimbabwe?
I've run a human rights practice in Zimbabwe since 1983 and represented Joshua Nkomo and ZAPU at a time when many black lawyers were too scared to represent his central committee and members of parliament. So in the 1980s, I gained a reputation for representing black opposition politicians then. I also played a major role in writing a report published in 1997 which exposed the genocide of the 1980s. And then in 1999, when Morgan Tsvangirai, the trade unionist, set up the opposition MDC party, he approached me, asked me to come in to the MDC. I stood for election in June 2000 in a working class district, overwhelmingly black, 95% black, and beat my ZANU PF cabinet minister opponent with an 84% majority. I've done the same again in March.
Sorry, with an 84% majority. That is a figure that any politician I know would love to have. That is extraordinary.
Well, it is, and it's not a reflection of me. It's really a reflection of black Zimbabweans who are some of the most delightful people.
David, roll back a bit earlier than that, though. Do you come from farming stock?
Or? No, I don't. I was born in Zimbabwe. My father was Scottish. My maternal roots go deep to 1820. But I'm a first-generation Zimbabwean, so I don't have farming links. I have urban links. My father was a bank manager.
Oh, okay. Now, who are the key supporters of Mugabe? We've had a long list of people who are alienated, who are pretty cranky. We get the impression here that he has very little support. So who are we talking about? Key public servants or financiers, thugs?
It really
the
is.
The Tom-Tom McCoo?
It really is this ruling corrupt elite. It's he's probably down to 1,000 avid supporters domestically, and then internationally he relies on the North Koreans, the Cubans, and the Chinese. Even Russian President Putin, and this is quite an irony, described him as a dictator in the run-up to the G8 summit a couple of weeks back.
Castro supports him?
Oh, absolutely.
What's the rationale there? What's...
Well, I think it's an ideological support. Robert Mugabe was an avowed Marxist-Leninist. He drifted a bit from that in the early 1990s when he embraced the IMF and World Bank, but he's gone back to his roots.
Looks like I'm going to have to support our Prime Minister on another issue. This comes as a very difficult moment for me. John Howard's right and Fidel Castro's wrong. Okay, so he relies on a lack of action, really, doesn't he, from his... From Zimbabweans rather than on support?
Well, it's not a lack of action. I think that people within the country are fighting hard and courageously. But this is Africa. It's the forgotten continent. Australian journalists, for example, are barred from coming in. They face criminal prosecution if they come in. And if we look at what happened in
apartheid, of course, daren't come near the place.
The BBC.
Anyone who might have even heard the name of Tony Blair won't be.
I think they'd be hung, drawn and quartered if they came in.
Right, yeah.
But if you look at the struggle to end apartheid, it was ended through a combination of international and domestic pressure. There's plenty of domestic pressure.
Okay, let's spend the few minutes we've got together. What are the solutions, David? What should we, the world, be doing?
Well, I think that there are two things. Firstly, the international community, Australia in particular, as I'm speaking to an Australian audience tonight, needs to support those fighting democracy within the country. Civil society, the churches, people like Archbishop Pius Mulwe, the Catholic Archbishop, who are striking a real blow against this regime. They need support. That's the first thing. The second thing is international pressure needs to mount. We need, in my view, an indictment against this regime in the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity. We need
now, this,
that
is the, this is the lawyer talking now, isn't it?
Absolutely.
International Criminal Court. What charges?
Well, Article 7 of the Treaty of Rome says that the forcible transfer of a population is a crime against humanity. Forgetting about the genocide of the 1980s, we believe that there is now clear-cut evidence of forcible transfer of thousands of Zimbabweans, the poorest of the poor. And if that's not a crime against humanity, I don't know what is. We need Australia, we need India, we need other democratic nations in the world to raise this in the Security Council to get an indictment process underway.
Any chance of that happening?
Quite frankly, I don't think that there's a chance of securing the actual indictment. But that's no reason why we shouldn't try. Bear in mind that this is primarily a psychological battle being waged. This is a regime that is already on its knees economically. And it is buttressed now by the psychological support by principally President Mbeki and South Africa. And what we've got to do is remove that psychological support, make this person a complete pariah, make it impossible
for
him to
be a complete pariah, for heaven's sake.
Well, I mean,
apart from Fidel Castro,
he is in Australia.
Even we don't like him.
But in many parts of Africa, because there's such a dearth of information, people don't understand what he's doing to his own people. I often speak on South African talk shows. and black South Africans phone in to support Robert Mugabe. And I say, don't listen to me, a white Zimbabwean. Come up to Zimbabwe and see what Robert Mugabe is doing to black working class people. But the trouble is, in Africa, people don't know that. And that's why we need to raise...
Well, there are two reasons for that. Okay, a highly effective technique of censoring the reporting on Zimbabwe. But I would have thought an equally powerful tool is the lack of sophisticated communication system in your country, in Africa, in the
continent.
You'd
be surprised. We have digital television in Zimbabwe, and in the whole of Africa now. We don't have any independent radio stations in Zimbabwe, but in the rest of the southern African region...
There's no excuse for not knowing.
There's absolutely no excuse for not knowing, but we find that there's self-censorship in the South African Broadcasting Corporation. Many South African journalists are too scared to come into Zimbabwe, unlike some heroines from the Australian journalistic fraternity.
David, in the last minutes we've got, give us our instructions. The Gladys, the audience is called Gladys, that's the audience's name, want to know what you want them to do.
Well, speaking to your audience tonight, I would say contact your local Member of Parliament, your local Senator, and bring pressure to bear on them. Ask them, what is the Australian government? We need to move away from rhetoric to action. We need Australia to be at the forefront of bringing this to the attention of the international community. Australia has a very important role to play.
Well, historically we do, in terms of...
Well, Australia opposed apartheid, and that gives you the moral authority to speak out against what is going on.
We had a Prime Minister once, a Conservative Prime Minister, who made Africa his special sort of issue.
Absolutely, and there are many ties with Zimbabwe. There are sporting ties, there are historical ties, there are linguistic ties, there's the ties of the Commonwealth.
David, you're a very persuasive fellow. And let me remind the listener, you're the Shadow Minister, the Shadow Justice Minister in Zimbabwe, but you're here in Australia to give the Sir Gerard Brennan Lecture at Bond University on the Gold Coast. I should remind the listeners that Sir Gerard was a very distinguished jurist in this country, and the lecture has been given by some very heavyweight people in recent years. It takes place at Bond University on the Gold Coast next week, and you'll also be visiting Sydney and Canberra and Melbourne before then. A pleasure and a privilege. LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, online and via podcasting.